What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Young Turks. I'm Anna Kasparian, and joining me today is Mark Thompson and Michael Shore. What's up, guys?
Great to see you, Anna.
Hey, good to see you guys.
Busy day.
Cenk is not in today, obviously, and neither is John, but it doesn't matter because we are going to have a great show. Michael came in with a breaking news story that we added to the first hour, and it is a doozy. I know everyone's talking about the Mika Brzezinski thing. We'll cover that too at some point in the show. But the real story today that was insanely, I guess not shocking, I mean nothing shocks me from the Trump administration, has to do with members of his team asking all 50 states to share voter information with the White House, which we'll give you the details on that and more.
Not even just voter information. When do you hear this?
Yeah, so you definitely want to stick around for that story. We'll do that when we come back from the break. But let's get started. We have a lot to cover today. Donald Trump is not only attempting to do extreme vetting of refugees who want to come to the country, he also is planning on doing extreme vetting of those seeking temporary visas. Now, make no mistake, vetting for temporary visas has been extremely rigorous anyway, but Trump believes that he needs to put more teeth to this extreme vetting process. And in fact, last week he signed an executive order, which got absolutely no attention in the press whatsoever. So let me give you the details of that executive order. So he signed this order last week, and it rescinded an Obama-era goal to speed up visa processing. Now, some of you might be wondering, like, oh, speed up the process? What does that mean? That doesn't sound safe. Well, the only thing that Obama wanted to do was ensure that within a certain amount of time, people applying for visas would be able to get an interview. That way, members of the government would be able to determine whether or not this individual is safe to allow into the country. So, a 2012 order signed by former President Obama instructed the State Department to ensure that 80% of non-immigrant visa applicants are interviewed within 3 weeks of receipt of application. So again, this doesn't mean that you just let them in. It just means, hey, how about we interview them within 3 weeks? Which doesn't sound unreasonable. Well, Donald Trump did think it was unreasonable. In fact, his White House spokesperson says the president expects careful, accurate vetting of visa applicants, not a rushed process to accommodate an arbitrary deadline. Now, there are unintended downsides to what Trump has done. By signing that executive order, he is negatively impacting innocent people that actually do add some benefits to our economy. So for instance, tourists. Tourists from certain countries have to apply for these temporary visas. And if Trump is making it even more difficult for them to travel here for tourism reasons, well, then they're unlikely to apply or even waste their time trying to come here, right? So the tourism industry is already dealing with some of the negative the downsides of Trump's presidency. Also, keep in mind that we have a number of students who travel abroad, they come to the United States in order to study. If you lengthen the process to obtain the visa, many of them are unlikely to be able to start classes on time. And then finally, there's the issue of H-1B visas. These are individuals, foreigners, who are hired to come into the country and work for various businesses. So this is not a business-friendly policy. This is certainly not a good policy for people who want to come here and use their talents in order to contribute to our companies.
From a president who pitches himself as the big business friendly guy, let me tell you, we're going to revolutionize the way we do things in the USA, and it's all going to be about business and jobs. And Anna's absolutely right. I mean, there's a tremendous business incentive here because there's research being done. There's all kinds of business development being done with other countries. I mean, one of the things that technology has done is it's brought us into sort of an interlocking relationship with other nations. And oftentimes we need those people from those other nations here working on things from an economic standpoint to help make this a more robust economy. This is ridiculous. You need a deadline on visas of some kind, right? I love that verbiage. They're so good at that crap verbiage, this administration.
Right.
Some arbitrary deadline, as though it's not arbitrary. We need a deadline that's reasonable so that people can make a plan, so that businesses can thrive, and so that tourism, which by the way is not an insubstantial business in this country, so tourism can thrive. So they're serious, in addition to all the other aspects to this. There's a serious business problem with this entire proposal.
There is, and it's interesting because, you know, the Republican Party claims that they're very much pro-business. But again, this is going to hurt businesses that do rely on these H-1B visas or H-1B visa holders to come in and contribute to their companies.
Not to mention, it's summertime.
Right.
And the tourist dollars that matter so much to so many destinations for foreign tourists coming into the United States at this time of year are unbelievable. And especially from the Southern Hemisphere voter visitor tourists, people coming from everywhere from Argentina to Australia to Southern, people coming to United States. It totally changes the way that happens. And
yes,
that does affect chambers of commerce.
So you're saying it's winter there, they're coming here for summer.
Exactly.
This the timing on this couldn't be worse from a tourism standpoint. I mean, this is really
right,
where a lot of tourism dollars get spent.
And by the way, let me just absolutely clarify what I think is the most important part of all of this, right? What Obama wanted, again, wasn't to ease the process for people attempting to obtain these visas. The only thing he wanted to do was, hey, let's have a more reasonable time span in which these people can expect to get interviewed. So they're still going through the same vetting channels. They're still getting, you know, their background checks done. They're still getting interviewed. Everything is being done the way it's supposed to be done. And by the way, the Obama administration was criticized by people on the left for being a little too strict when it came to temporary visas for travelers. And Trump wants to take it even further. And so this is something that will run in tandem to the travel ban. So this is separate. Yes, the travel ban. It will run tandem to that. And this is also very different from the vetting process that he wants to utilize when it comes to refugees. So people who are trying to come into the country and essentially seek asylum because of what they're experiencing in their own countries. It's crazy. And by the way, we oftentimes mention what the vetting process is. We give the audience details. But for those of you who might be curious, what was the vetting process under the Obama administration? I have the details to that. Let's go to graphic 29A. So an individual from Iraq, for instance, who wants to visit the United States as a tourist, first fills out an online application for the visa. Before the interview, information in the application is run against US terrorism watch lists and databases. Any derogatory information would be flagged for a specially trained State Department consular office in the US embassy or consulate in or near the person's home country who conducts the interview. For high risk countries, the Department of Homeland Security is involved to some extent. At that point, the visa applicant needs to show proof that a return ticket has been purchased, a defined place to stay in the US, and ties to his or her home country. And this is something that the traveler would provide during the interviewing process. If and when the person is approved for a visa, photos and fingerprints are taken. Before departing for the US, all air passengers coming into the US are subject to information analysis by officials on the ground, overseas, and at the National Targeting Center in Virginia. Finally, once the traveler arrives at the US airport, an officer with Customs and Border Protection will have access to all of the information collected through the targeting center, will ask the person for his or her fingerprints again to match with the original set, and will ask questions again about the trip to the United States. So again, it is a lengthy process. It is a, you know, long, you know, detailed process. It's not like, I mean, I know that this country really thrives on fear, right? And the fear mongering by the right works to their, you know, benefit time and time again. But no one had open borders. No one said, hey, you know what? You want to come to the US? All right, no background checks, no nothing, just show up. It doesn't work that way. I know the Trump administration will have you believe that, but that is not the case.
These were stringent, they were rigorous, and they were right.
Yeah.
Right? And that they seem to be, like, I would say there are very few people would call them totally unreasonable. I should also clarify, I said Australia before. Of course, Australia, part of the visa waiver program, so you wouldn't need a visa anyway coming from Australia, but basically painting the picture of that side of the world. But when you get here, when you get to this country, and that is what you have to go through, that's pretty rigorous, and I think that's sufficient in many cases. And then those flags are raised. But as you said, Anna, there's never been or certainly in recent history, been you just waltz right into this country and you pick up your bag at baggage claim and you go to your hotel or your home.
I think there's also an aspect of this, and you see it in so much of these executive orders. There's just an aspect of this that is anti-Obama. I didn't think you could really govern this way, but they really are governing this way. If Obama's name is on something, they get rid of it.
It's almost as if, Mark, just like you guys both remember the White House Correspondents' Dinner where President Obama was ribbing Donald Trump, who was in attendance that night. Mm-hmm. And they were good digs, but they were digs. To me, it's almost as if he thinks about that with everything he does. That he is that little boy in the playground that is pissed off at the kid who teased him, and he is just going to do everything he can now that he's the king of the playground.
I don't even mean
that like facetiously or sarcastic. I really think that matters to him.
I 100% agree with you. And if you just look at the way that they're legislating, and they're legislating a lot through executive order, the first order of business was to undo a lot of what President Obama had done. And even in this specific case, they want to change what Obama had done. And it's important because Anna laid it out. It's a rigorous process already. But the headline steal is making Obama's immigration laws or immigration rules tougher,
right,
putting teeth in President Obama's immigration policy. When you get that headline, that's a headline that Donald Trump can warm up to. And I mean, it seems so superficial, but in an election that was ruled by superficial messaging, and in a president who is as shallow as they come, this is the kind of thing that makes for legislation that he stands behind.
Yeah.
So I think it's all about a lot about that anyway.
Yeah, you're actually absolutely right about that. And you can tell based on the way headlines are written about this particular story, because you got to keep in mind, not every American has the time or the resources to sit down, you know, read every detail of every story, understand the nuance behind it. And so a lot of people are educated based on what they read in headlines. And so the headline from The Hill, for instance, says Trump quietly puts teeth into his extreme vetting policy. That's a very positive headline.
Right.
And it doesn't really give you a sense of all of the negative ramifications of what he's doing.
Nor does it even touch on the fact that he's not really doing much, just lengthening the process.
He's just lengthening the process.
That's not putting teeth in anything. There's no creative legislation going on with that.
Right.
But again, as Anna says, it'll steal the click, right? You see that one thing and you go, oh, yeah, well, you know, one of the things I like about Donald Trump is, you know, he's made this, he's put some teeth into our immigration policy.
Definitely. And these are the types of things that when you have executive orders, you have to do, because when you say them, you're just saying them, and then this is the enactment of that. We'll talk about a few more of those later, but this is exactly how you're characterizing it.
The last thing I want to say on this, because I think this security thing, when you talk about the fact that they've sold security and that we're frightened, I think that's so right. And security is clearly going to be a big theme with this administration for his entire 4 years, that under that umbrella of security, you can do a lot of stuff, like take people's civil rights away.
Right.
So right now, we're messing with people who are coming here and you go, well, you know, I'm not from, you know, wherever that is, and I'm not from these countries that are affected. I live here. Yeah, but after 9/11, all of us who lived here, we gave up a bunch of civil rights. We were scared, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was security. And they sold us on that fact that, hey, look.
Everything fell under that. That was the Patriot Act. That was exactly what happened with the Patriot Act.
And
yeah. Robert
Fourth Amendment goes away.
Robert Byrd in the Senate talking about how crazy creating the Department of Homeland Security was, right? When you think about that, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, people standing up and saying that, and you're not hearing enough about this stuff. One of the interesting things I think from this was Rex Tillerson, this hiring freeze he put in at the State Department, right? It's almost a way to say we don't have enough people to process the visas. It's a way of doing it in a backdoor, sneaky way to say we're just not going to hire. We're hiring freeze, so we can't hire enough people to process the visas.
They've done that in a lot of different arms of government. There are aspects of this administration that are, I think, really dedicated to that kind of governing, which is, hey, we just don't have the manpower. Sorry.
Right. And keep in mind, there are so many positions that Trump still hasn't filled. National security positions, by the way. So that's something you should also keep in mind while he pretends like he's concerned about your national security.
But he was really pissed about only 8 people on the Supreme Court. Had to fill that one.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, that was the issue and only issue. So anyway, on to
All right. Well, there are other promises that Trump obviously made during his campaign that he's not keeping. So let's get to that. Donald Trump claimed to really care about the opioid epidemic when he was campaigning. In fact, on several different occasions, he brought up the issue and said that he was going to look out for the American people and ensure that we had a system in place to take care of them. Let's take a look at a fun little montage that the Washington Post put together of all of these different examples.
Drug abuse has become a crippling problem throughout the United States. Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of accidental death in our country. And opioid overdose deaths have nearly quadrupled since 1999. This is a total epidemic. We will fight to increase access to life-saving treatment to battle the addiction to drugs, which is afflicting our nation like never, ever before. We're going to be ruthless in that fight. We have no choice.
The heroin is really tough because they say once you get hooked, it's really tough. In all fairness to your son, it's a tough thing. Some very, very strong people have not been able to get off it. So we have to work with people to get off it.
And we're going to battle it in two fronts. We're going to do the clinics. We're going to work it so they can do the clinics and do them locally so they're locally based and run. That's not so different than the education. We want it locally based and run. In the meantime, people are hooked. And I don't know what it is with heroin, but it just seems to be a really tough one to get away from. But it can be done. And we're going to take care of the people.
So it's interesting that he claimed that he cared so much about the issue, because as the Senate was drafting its replacement plan for Obamacare's repeal, they of course cut a ton of funding that would go toward helping those who are addicted to prescription painkillers or heroin. Now, as a result, there were some more moderate Republicans in the Senate that said that they would vote against it because their own constituents are really suffering as a result of the opioid epidemic. So what is the response to that? Well, it turns out that those on the far right are trying to sweeten the deal for moderate Republicans by increasing funding for opioid victims, right? But the way that it's going down should have you concerned. So addiction experts and others across the political spectrum say that boosting the current bill's $2 billion for substance abuse services is like applying a Band-Aid to a shotgun wound. It's complex, lifelong medical problem that requires regular health care. Now, they're planning on increasing that $2 billion by an additional $45 billion. And again, it's not because they're genuinely concerned about looking out for Americans who are dealing with this addiction. They just want to make sure that moderate Republicans sign on to this. But even moderate Republicans are kind of rolling their eyes and saying, this isn't enough. In fact, John Kasich says, that's like spitting in the ocean. Also, West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito says, or also along with Senator Rob Portman, said Wednesday that money would have to be paired with more generous Medicaid provisions to get her support. Now, you guys know that Senate Republicans want to cut Medicaid. The Senate bill would make $772 billion in cuts to Medicaid over 10 years, including the rollback of the federal government's funding of Obamacare's expanded Medicaid eligibility, through which an estimated 1.3 million people have gotten mental health care and substance abuse coverage. So it's not just about having some sort of slush fund, it's about having a comprehensive strategy and plan in place in order to take care of these individuals.
Exactly. You can't just throw money at this. You have to have some kind of, it's a real policy. And I love that word strategy. That's exactly what you need. You need to be tactical about where that money's spent and how it's spent. And this is just a buy-off, right?
In a way, it's a buy-off, especially when you listen to the senators that are talking about, Capito and Portman, both senators who they're not certain how they're going to vote yet on the revised AHCA coming out of the Senate. Hearing them sort of criticize this, John Kasich, who spent the entirety of his campaign, he had a New Hampshire-centric campaign, and he spent the entirety of that campaign talking about opioid addiction and the problem in that state. Maggie Hassan, who's the senator from, former governor and senator from New Hampshire, saying, you know, listen, if you're going to come into the state to do that, it's a drop in the bucket. Because if you don't have an integrated health care network to take care of these people, it doesn't matter. And it goes to what Anna was saying about the Band-Aid on the on the, what was it?
The gunshot wound,
right. I was going to go with shark bite, but
yeah, that works.
I think it's the same thing.
Same imagery.
It's, you know, my anti-gun thing. I won't even talk about it. and so it's embarrassing, and it's embarrassing too, and this point has to be made, for senators who fall for it. So if the White House thinks that they're going to get somewhere with this, that then you're a fool if you're a senator and you buy into this crap, because there's no way that this is going to be implemented as just money if there's no network, like Senator Hassan said. So I think that's really, I mean, you could listen to the White House say whatever they want. You can listen to what the senators who are crafting this are saying. But you are a foolish senator if you fall for this, if this changes your vote. And hopefully Capito and Portman don't because of this.
Well, right. If you really care about the opioid epidemic, I mean, it's, you always, there's a lot of politics being played in Washington now, and there's not a lot of concern for these issues in any kind of real substantive way.
I love that you mentioned that, because I think for some of the more moderate Republicans, I don't know if they're genuinely moderate because of their principles and what they believe politically, or if they're moderate because of their constituents, right? And so I think the most powerful thing that's come out of this story is the incredible impact that these constituents have had. And I know that Capito was confronted by a woman who wants to protect the Affordable Care Act, and also talked about, you know, her terminally ill daughter and how important the Affordable Care Act is to her. And so voicing your concerns does move some of these politicians and does somehow miraculously convince them that, hey, maybe not listening to your donors for a second and actually listening to the people who vote for you matters. So what I'm concerned about is whether or not it's going to be a political calculation by these moderate Republicans, right? Because if they go ahead and say to their constituents, hey, but we fought and we got that extra $45 billion to take care of you guys, who knows? Some might be fooled by that. Some of the constituents might be tricked into thinking that's good enough. But make no mistake, it's not good enough. You do need a comprehensive strategy, which, by the way, no one talks about this at all. Neither the Republicans or the Democrats talk about this. But you also need to do something to regulate pharmaceutical companies and ensure that they can't, you know, encourage or persuade doctors to overprescribe highly addictive drugs. And that's, you know, a big part of why this is all happening.
Yeah, these are prescription medications, and you're absolutely right. And by now, there's been plenty written and plenty displayed in documentary of one sort or another about how the medical industry is helping to support the opioid epidemic. I keep wanting to say academic, but the epidemics involving opioids are fed through that whole pharmaceutical medical industry. So. Yeah, there's a decoding. This is not hard, but I think defanging it is much harder. It's a big problem that Absolutely. Is, as you say, in need of a strategy, not just money.
And there aren't a lot of, I'm sorry, moderate Republicans. Let's not get carried away here. These are not necessarily moderate people. And, you know, with the exception of Susan Collins, and I think you should moderate if your constituents are more moderate, certainly as a congressman, but as a senator too, I think you should, because that's who you're, it's not as representative, and I know you're there to sort of be who you are. But with the exception of Susan Collins, there's no bite in any of these barks. I mean, Capito's father was Arch Moore, who was a Republican governor of West Virginia, who was sort of ahead of his time as a Republican in talking about health care. But he was still, I mean, he wasn't right there. Her pedigree is not moderate. Her pedigree is very different than that. So the fact that she's coming around on this doesn't make her a moderate, just moderating on this issue, which I think it's really important to distinguish.
Right, you're right about that. By the way, I just want to end the story with a quick comment from an unnamed White House official who spoke to Axios and said the following. Let's go to graphic 13. I think we're going to get this to pass, or I think we're going to pass this. I really think they'll bribe off the moderates with opioid money and then actually move policy to shore up Mike Lee and Ted Cruz. I just thought that the wording there was fascinating, and I wanted to make sure that you guys heard it.
And that's the political calculation that you're talking about.
Yeah. I love that they straight up use the word bribe.
Right. You know? Yeah.
That's what our political system's all about.
And that's what we were just talking about.
Yeah, it's a buy-off.
It's a buy-off, and you better not fall for it, because you're the fool if you're the senator who falls for the bribe.
Exactly. All right, guys, let's take our first break. When we come back, the story that I promised you regarding White House officials asking for personal information about every voter in all 50 states. And then later on, we will cover the story between Mika Brzezinski, Donald Trump, and all the nonsense with the childish president that we unfortunately elected. So come right back.
Liberal politician.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Young Turks. Anna, Mark, and Michael with you. I want to do member shout outs first. Brian Rin, and also Peggy Warner. Thank you so much for being members. You guys help support our show and keep us independent. And also some TYT lives for you. Vive la Revolution says, didn't Melania come to the United States on an H-1B visa?
Oh.
She did, right? I don't know. I feel like there was something up with her visa.
It was an H-1BJ visa.
Oh, thank you. Come on.
Sorry. Okay.
All right. El Duende Chingon says, don't worry, you can still get in if you make your check payable directly to the Kushners. Great reference to a story earlier this year about how the Kushner family traveled to China and said, hey, what's up, man? If you invest $500,000 in one of our properties, and then we can get you that golden visa, which is so freaking maddening because there are so many downsides to that. Not only does it, squeeze out people who might desperately need to be here, right, just to escape violence in their own countries, but like you have these wealthy people from other countries buying up our properties and then raising the price of homes, and the middle class gets squeezed out. It's just. Anyway, I did a great piece on that. You guys should check it out on Facebook. All right. And then finally, Drew S. says, does anybody think lately about what kind of drugs our buffoon is using? By the way he acts moment to moment. I don't know if he uses drugs. I have no idea, right? But I do wonder about his mental health. And I'm not saying that to insult him. I just feel like there's something going on there that.
I just think he's a vacuous guy. I don't think there's a lot going on there. I don't think he's good even at business. We've talked about that on the show ad nauseum. But I mean, but your point's well taken in that he seems mercurial and weird and tweets crap in the middle of the night and then gets on a jihad against, MSNBC hosts. You're right. He's crazy. If it were anyone else, you might ascribe it to kind of a bipolar disorder, somebody off their meds, whatever it might be. In his case, if it's really true that he doesn't take anything, then he's just an effed up cat, man.
Remember his doctor from the campaign? Remember that with the some pictures? So if you think of that, I mean, I know nothing about
him. He's got the rock and roll doctor.
So maybe, there's something there.
All right, now for the story that I promised you. Trump's so-called election panel has asked all 50 states for voter roll information, essentially information on every voter in these states. Now, Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who also happens to be the vice chairman of President Trump's Commission on Election Integrity, is seeking several pieces of information about voters, including their names, birthdays, the last four digits of their social security numbers, and their voting history dating back to 2006. Now, the letter that was sent to the secretaries of state of all 50 states was obtained by The Hill. So The Hill did the reporting on this. And it directs states to turn over publicly available voter roll data, including, if publicly available under the laws of your state, the full first and last names of all registrants, middle names or initials if available, addresses, dates of birth, political party, last four digits of social security, if available, and voter history from 2006 onward. So this story was a late addition to our rundown today. Michael Shore came in and he's like, we need to cover this. And so I want to actually throw it to you first to get your commentary. What do you think? Why is this so problematic?
Well, it's problematic because it's an invasion of privacy. And this is somebody who has spent a good deal of his time trying to suppress votes. He is an anti-immigrant. He's somebody who helped craft. He's from Kansas, remember, but he helped craft SB 1070 in Arizona, that very frightfully racist piece of legislation that was targeting immigrants in Arizona, did something similar in Arkansas. He's from Kansas, let's keep reminding you. He's the Kansas Secretary of State.
And SB 1070 was from several years ago, so I just want to make sure that you guys are up to date on that. It would essentially allow police officials to ask anyone for proof that they're in the country legally, right? Yeah. So it essentially gave them a pass to profile people who weren't white. And so, yeah, there was a lot of backlash to that.
It was like having a national ID card practically, which is something that we in this country don't have. There are reasons to and not to have that, but this is not coming from the purest place. So he is a guy who has consistently said that there is voter fraud, rampant voter fraud in this country, supported the president when the president has said millions of fraudulent votes in the 2016 election. And he is also someone who said he had all this proof for what happened in New Hampshire. The reason Trump lost New Hampshire was because there were so many false votes of people coming in from Massachusetts to vote in New Hampshire. None of this, zero, was proven. He is also the only state secretary of state in the country who has the power to prosecute voter fraud. And because he kind of granted himself that power in a legislature like Kansas that is, a majority Republican conservative legislature, was able to get that power, he has prosecuted some cases. A handful, a couple, some were overturned on appeal. There is not a problem. This is not a problem in America. This administration and this guy think that it is. So going after everybody on every voter roll down to social security numbers. And so, of course, he's getting pushback. Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, said, we are not going to participate. Merrill in Connecticut, she said, we're not going to participate. We'll participate with some of it, but we're not going to give information that isn't already public. You know, there's a guy called Jay Ashcroft. I don't know if you've ever heard that name. He's the Secretary of State in Missouri. And he has said that, oh, it's a great idea. We'll participate. It's funny where your bedfellows come. But that's the whole of it. This is dangerous. This is voter suppression. This is getting people, this is intimidating people to register to vote. If you have a felony, if you don't, if you have a misdemeanor, if you are worried that you have something in your checkered past, and you know that your social security number and your information and your address, if you are being stalked, if you are a woman who is abused and you don't want this information public, then you're not going to give it. And if registering to vote means you have to give it, you're not going to register to vote. And guess who goes home happy? Chris Kobach.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring that up, because for me personally, as I was reading the story, the publishing of this information, which they do intend on doing. The letter also stipulates that documents submitted to the commission will also be made available to the public. First of all, I think most Americans, regardless of where you lie on the political spectrum, understand that when you publish information that contains things like your address and the last four digits of your social security number, I mean, you are just creating a wealth of information for people who want to hack into financial accounts and things like that. So that's, of course, a concern of mine. Another concern is that this could be used as a form of political intimidation, right? The Trump administration is collecting data on you, and they know who you voted for and how you voted since 2006. But finally, what if you are a public figure, such as myself, and you want to protect your address, right? You've gone to extreme lengths to protect your address. Now this information is going to be publicized? No, that's insane, right? And so it will absolutely discourage people from registering to vote.
Well, and a simple computer search could come up with your name and address in a nanosecond. You know? I mean, once these files are available that way, then it'll be very easy to find any of our names and addresses, and any American that you want to violate in terms of their privacy in that fashion. I've always thought of the voting process is so sacred here. It's weird how you grow up with that sense that voting in America is really a sacred process, and we celebrate it, and we say this is the best process politically in the world. I mean, whether or not that's even true anymore. But you have a sense of that the sanctity of what's going on with that vote and with your registration. And now it's odd, and if I can say, almost un-American to have it pierced this way.
Sure, you can say that, Mark.
Okay, well, I just said it.
Okay. Yeah. You're right, though. It is. And it's when you John Lewis is in the Congress, he'll probably have a thing or two to say about this. This is another executive order from your president. And he is following through on these. This actually isn't. The commission itself was created out of executive order. This is bad news. This voter intimidation in America has always gone on. It's always come from one party in modern history. It continues to, and it has to be stopped. And this is constitutionally challenging.
But this ties in with the other theme of this guy who's so driven by ego that he's chasing this crap that he was throwing around about the election and all the illegal votes.
He thinks he won New Hampshire. You're right, Mark. He wants everybody to think he won New Hampshire. And what this is.
Everyone thought that he was going to drop this stuff once he became president. Hey, you won. Like you dropped the Hillary Clinton thing, lock her up. Let's drop it already. I mean, you're in now. But he's not. He's chasing this because he wants to say, no, damn it, you're not dropping this. I said it, and you're not going to make me a fool. In fact, I'm going to establish a commission to investigate this. By the way, commissions cost money. So it does cost taxpayer money to chase this guy's ego dream, whatever it is.
This is going to cost a ton of money. Yeah. It's going to cost states money, too, because the states are going to have to put these roles together.
If they decide they don't want to put the roles together, they're going to have to contest it in court.
Legally.
And that's going to cost money.
Because of this guy's ego trip. This
exactly.
Is a big goddamn ego trip.
All right. Now let's move on to some of the nonsense. Childish nonsense that we're seeing from Trump. Although Morning Joe was pretty friendly toward Trump and his campaign while he was running, after he got elected, they've been more critical, and I think that that's been pretty evident. Now, recently, Morning Joe decided to talk about how Donald Trump had fake Time magazine covers of himself in as many as 5 of his golf courses throughout the world. And, you know, they poked a little fun at him. In fact, take a look at what Mika Brzezinski had to say.
Nothing makes a man feel better than making a fake cover of a magazine about himself, lying every day and destroying the country.
Okay.
It's a good feeling.
Enough about me.
Where are your hands in that photo?
He's covering his hands here because they're teensy.
The other crazy thing about that.
Now,
she really does go after him. I hadn't seen that piece of tape. She really goes after him.
Now, right now, there is speculation as to whether or not that particular segment set Trump off on a little bit of a Twitter tiff. He goes on Twitter and he starts attacking Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. And he says something that has led to a little bit of backlash, even from Republicans. So let me read you those tweets. He says, he's such a child. I heard poorly rated Morning Joe speaks badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Yes, you do. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika along with psycho Joe came to Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. So Trump seems to have some weird obsession with women and blood, because remember, he attacked Megyn Kelly for asking him a mildly difficult question during a debate and said, oh, she's bleeding from her whatever he said. And so that was, you know, his latest attack against Mika, talking about, you know, her looks and I don't know, you guys take it. I'm just so tired of this shit.
Well, you know, the first thing I thought of when I read it was that Melania Trump's big cause is cyberbullying.
Yeah. It's amazing, right?
And this, you know, buffoon lying next to her in bed is doing this.
I doubt they're lying in the same bed.
Whatever,
but that's, you know,
just in general.
Be that as it may.
Painting a picture of.
I see. You meant it metaphorically.
Familial bliss.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
Playing with their dogs and goldfish, but yeah, I mean, and then thinking just how disgusting this is, right?
Right.
And how beneath the office, and also how I knew what Republican senators were going to say, like, oh, this is terrible, and that would be it.
No, this is terrible, but I still support it,
right.
Which is exactly the kind of response we got from Republicans.
In some cases, it went farther. And I know, Anna, you're going to have a couple of those, but the general acceptance that this is the way this guy conducts business is what is so off-putting.
It is off-putting for us because we don't expect the leader of this country to be a child. We expect him to act a certain way and set an example and be a leader, and he is the antithesis of that.
Because we also expect that our senators and our members of Congress are going to stand up to this.
At some point.
The voters who he appealed to, for whatever reason, across whatever spectrum he was able to pull them. And I know that you're in the middle of a thought, but I have to say that you expect more. You don't expect more from this guy because that's what he was sent there for. But you expect more for the people who are a buffer between those voters and this president and us to stand up to this, and they don't do it enough.
Well, I think everything, I mean, if you put this entire situation in context, starting from, you know, the campaign to the election to where we are today, all of this has been incredibly disappointing, because I don't think that this is just a reflection of Trump. I think it's a reflection of the American people. I think it's a reflection of our lawmakers. And it's incredibly disappointing when you think about the fact that, you know, there are literally children that have handle situations more maturely than our lawmakers do. And there are children who probably understand how wrong it is for Trump to say these types of things about anyone. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. This type of rhetoric should not be acceptable. But the point that I was trying to make was that, look, this is not the kind of story that his base cares about. His base knows what kind of person he is. I mean, he gets caught on tape talking about grabbing women by the genitals. He, you know, refers to women as pigs. He, you know, talks about Megyn Kelly menstruating and acts as if that is like the worst thing, the most embarrassing thing for a woman. I mean, he has a history of saying incredibly despicable things to women time and time again. If anything, there are members of his base that love this kind of stuff. And they think that he's a strong person because he continuously insults people without caring about the ramifications. But, you know, the only people who are really concerned and really put off by this are people who aren't going to vote for him anyway. And so, again, this whole situation is so incredibly disappointing and discouraging, because I think it says a lot about where we are as a society, right? I think people pretended like they were civil, but no, we're not civil. We're freaking animals, and we treat each other like crap. And I don't care where you are in your political ideology. We all need to take a step back and really rethink the way that we're communicating with one another. This is disgusting. Now, let's hear from
just to say that was great. I mean, really, that is it, because I love that you took it from the specific to the general. Mm-hmm. And then I'll stop. But Twitter oddly has fed what Anna's talking about.
Yeah, so here, absolutely.
His
not oddly,
Twitter
definitely.
Comments have ended up in this machine of hate and this machine of division. And so you really see it played out, the cyberbullying, you see it played out every day in so many tweets across the board. So in a way, Donald Trump is feeding that machine. And Twitter is just a symptom of what Anna's talking about, which is that the society has become so divisive in its dialogue that nothing is too personal and nothing's too rude.
That, yeah, absolutely. And by the way, Mika did have a response to it. She tweeted, she didn't tweet to him, but she tweeted that box of Cheerios made for
that?
Little hands.
I saw it earlier, but I love seeing it.
Which is pretty funny. And so I bring that up only because nothing gets under his skin more than insults about his hands. And that's another thing. Like, I want a president who doesn't have such thin skin, man. Like, he gets insulted so easily, and he gets up in arms and he loses his temper and he goes on Twitter and he's like, oh, how dare you talk about the size of my hands? I have gigantic hands. Anyway.
Well, this is a guy who held a cabinet meeting specifically to be dedicated to at least the first 5 minutes of it, complimenting him on the job he's doing, right? And how grateful you are
so
to be around him. I mean, he needs not only not to be insulted, but he needs people ingratiating themselves to him constantly.
And Ben Sasse, the Republican who has just been at his throat since day one. You know, to his credit, he's probably the most consistent Republican against Trump.
He's got
tweeted,
some sass. Yeah.
Please just stop. This isn't normal, and it's beneath the dignity of your office, which clearly it is. And it would be great if more people with jobs that like Ben Sasse's said the same thing.
So some Republicans did come out and say that they were not in favor of the inappropriate language that Trump is using on social media. However, they still support him. One of those lawmakers is, of course, Paul Ryan. Let's hear from him.
You have been critical of the president when he has, you know, made some comments that you have felt are out of line. Are these comments out of line?
Are you talking about this morning's tweet? Yeah, I just saw it a little bit ago. Obviously, I don't see that as an appropriate comment. I think, look, what we're trying to do around here is improve the tone and the civility of the debate. And this obviously doesn't help do that.
I mean, Michael, look, I loathe Paul Ryan, so but please, I must offer that disclaimer. But when you were just saying, you know, we need more of what politicians stop short of saying anything. I don't know what the guy could. If I'm Paul Ryan, I mean, even as Mark Thompson is Paul Ryan, I think I say probably the same thing. If my political future is wedded to that guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if you're Tip O'Neill, or you're Jim Wright, you say the president's got to stop doing this. Right?
You say that publicly to the press?
You say it publicly. Tip O'Neill would have said that publicly to the press.
I just think politically you don't gain anything. This guy's not going to change.
Politically,
you can't change
him. But you're the Speaker of the House, right? I mean, listen, it's not just ideal pie-in-the-sky stuff. This is basic politics. I think you do get somewhere with it. This is a guy who was belittled by Donald Trump himself, Paul Ryan. And yes, they are talking about civility. They are talking about...
These guys are a bunch of spineless a-holes.
No. Their colleague, a member of his leadership team, was shot and almost killed on a baseball field. They're talking about civility. This is happening in the middle of discourses about civility.
Yes.
So they have to be more critical of it than they otherwise would be.
That's especially with that background. Yeah, and look, I criticize, you know, the rhetoric that's being used on both sides, although I would argue that, you know, the violent rhetoric is, you know, more common on the right. But look, it's just incredible because that shooting happened. It was tragic and disgusting, and it made me take a step back and think about my own rhetoric, and I want to make sure that I do my job responsibly. And that kind of, you know, thought process seems to only happen on the left. It's the same standard that should be, you know, expected from the right as well. So you can't be using rhetoric that, you know, demonizes people just because they insulted the size of your hands. You know, you should stand up, be a leader. I think Paul Ryan, here's an opportunity to be a leader and do more than just say like, oh yeah, that was inappropriate, I'm not in favor of it, but I still support the president. Okay, let's move on, let's talk about something else.
Right,
because that's what we get from them time and time again.
Of course, and I think that's what we'll get from them till the end of time, the end of Trump time. But I think when you're called upon by your party, which is the way they see themselves, to a higher goal, sort of an ends justifies the means kind of approach to politics, there's just no percentage in taking your criticism of the president any further. You know he's not going to change. Paul Ryan knows that whatever he says is not going to change anything.
But it doesn't matter. They have to have some balls about this. They have to be able, you're not going to change Donald Trump. That's fine, but change the way that you're perceived and bind together to, you know, stop being like as they have been, bind together and go at the president, not because you're going to change him, but because you're going to change the way you are perceived.
Yes, of course I agree, but I would say you're asking from these guys who've demonstrated clearly that they're not capable of that move. I mean, they are sleeping with the serpent and they're okay with it. You're asking them to do something that they are just incapable of doing.
Sleeping with the Serpent sounds like a good movie title. Anyway, we got to go to another break. Let's do that. Not that kind of movie title. Anyway, sorry.
I hadn't thought of that.
I just
that sounds like a better movie, though.
Anyway, all right. Let's take a break. When we come back, more news for you. And I will read your tweet. So tweet to us using hashtag TYTLive. Hey guys, welcome back to TYT. A few TYT lives for you. My favorite one was from I Am Sock. He says, or she says, how can Trump punch back 10 times harder with such tiny hands? I just feel like since it gets under his skin so much, people should focus more on insulting his tiny hands. Also, Captain Jingle Pants says, Ryan doesn't have a spine. He'll never have a spine. Good thing he has so much power. Pretty devastating, yeah.
That's pretty true too.
That's exactly the point.
There's such spineless on his part. They're not all spineless.
Well, the leadership's spineless.
Right, the leadership is pretty spineless. Yeah, I would say leader. I mean, it depends on what you're looking for in a spine. Scalise is actually scarily spineful.
It depends what you're looking for in a spine.
Well, I mean,
I see what you're saying, across the spectrum, there's more texture to it than
But no, but I'm just arguing for the sake of arguing. They're largely spineless on the leadership, yeah.
All right, I want to do one more first hour story for you guys before Grace comes in and we do the second hour. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is upset that the media continues to criticize Trump and not focus on all the good things that she thinks that he's done that he actually hasn't done at all. Case in point, reforming the VA. Take a look.
We've been going on this Russia Trump hoax for the better part of a year now with no evidence of anything. Things like the success at the VA barely get covered. They may get covered for an hour at a time, but this story gets covered day in, day out. And I think America is frankly looking for something better.
Now, back in March, we covered a story regarding members of the military, former members of the military, so veterans, who had gone to the White House expecting to meet with Donald Trump to talk about things like reforming the VA. And they, unfortunately, were not met with Donald Trump. They were met by Omarosa. And they were livid about that because they feel as though they were exploited during the campaign. And unfortunately, now that he's been elected, he's been ignoring the issues that matter most to them. Now, if you don't believe me or the reporting on this, why don't we hear from an actual former Navy SEAL? In fact, the Navy SEAL who shot and killed Osama bin Laden during that raid in Pakistan.
Well, thank you, Anna. It was...
All right, so Robert O'Neill, who was part of the Navy team.
SEAL Team 6.
SEAL Team 6, yes, who was part of SEAL Team 6 and who claims was the one who shot and killed Osama bin Laden, was pretty outraged at that comment by Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And here's what he had to say about it. I just heard Sanders talk about successes at the VA. Please explain, and I would love to debate you. VA is a damn insult to vets. He continues to say, following up to Sarah Huckabee on the VA, I'm a combat vet, killed Osama bin Laden, and I pay for private health care. Most vets can't afford it. And then he says that he's insulted by her for praising the VA today. I bet you never had your wallet stolen by staff while getting a CAT scan. I have. And finally, he says, I want to invite her to go with me to any VA to see how awful they are. I'm sure daddy got you better health care and that job. So he went after her pretty aggressively, right?
And he's not wrong.
Right. And he's not. He's not. I mean, again, like going back to the story that we covered about, you know, some of the terrible things that Trump tweeted about Mika Brzezinski. It was to be expected. He showed his true colors when he was campaigning in regard to women. And the same is true of vets. It's true that he exploited vets, pretended like he cared about them when he didn't at all. Remember when he pretended like he was fundraising for them?
Yeah, yeah, and then he delayed that check.
Yeah.
They didn't even get a check with it until the Washington Post smoked him out and made him write the check to the VA, or to the vets in this case.
It's just... it's despicable, and I'm glad that there is, you know, a veteran who is coming out and saying, no, 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 don't try to take credit for something that you didn't do. You didn't reform anything. The VA still needs help, and no, that's not going to be something to distract reporters from, you know, an investigation that does have components that are worth investigating. I mean, you freaking you fired the FBI director because he was investigating, you know, the potential collusion or possible collusion. I mean, that alone is a red flag. So anyway,
I think about Robert Mueller, you know, in his office watching Sarah Huckabee saying, you know, there's no evidence and you've got this Russian investigation, which there's no evidence, and Mueller must be like, like that,
yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah.
Of course, he's sitting in front of evidence of some kind.
This is, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, because I think Michael's right and Anna's right about the divisiveness, and Michael's right about when he talks about the fact that I understand the GOP is really, there's a plurality on the GOP side, just like there's a plurality on our side, on the progressive side. I mean, we all don't line up exactly the same way. But having said that, the GOP does tend to wrap themselves in patriotism every way they can. And they do it in a lot of superficial ways, with the flag and with the military. And when Trump rode into Washington on the backs of those vets, and we knew that he didn't give a shit about those vets in any way that mattered. And we knew it, even if you were new to the party, based on the fundraisers and sort of, again, how superficial that whole thing was.
No, and also, I have another example that I encourage all of you to look into, you know, just in case you don't want to take my word for it, and you shouldn't take my word for it. You should look into it yourself. Look, he remember he rolled out his budget proposal? What did his budget proposal do? The Military Times reported that it was going to cut funding for veterans. Cut funding for veterans. So he's running his mouth about how much he cares about the vets, how much he wants to reform the VA. No, no, no. You have shown us time and time again that you are exploiting, you know, individuals who need help the most for your own political gain and your own personal gain. You are a despicable, disgusting human being for doing so. And the audacity of Sarah Huckabee Sanders to be like, no, 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 don't focus on anything that criticizes the president. Only focus on something positive. positive that he hasn't even done.
Yeah, that was the thing. I mean, yeah. To mention the vets and the VA is crazy. Yeah. I mean, now Trump mentions the military all the time because, again, that falls into a patriotic, we need a strong military. And in any case, it was a weird reference because of how bankrupt it is of any truth.
And base closings, by the way, which his, secretary and his administration want to start implementing base closings. It's going to be a challenge for Mattis, but it's going to be something they're talking about.
When they talk about strengthening the military, let's be clear. They're talking about money, and nobody wastes money like the Pentagon. Nobody wastes money in Washington like the Pentagon does. Maybe Michael Shore wastes money. But they're talking about weapons systems. They're talking about things that will give defense contractors big money. It's all part of the same machine.
Right, exactly. All right, guys, that does it for hour one. Thank you to Mark Thompson and Michael Shore for joining me. You guys want to plug anything before you go?
The Edge Show.
I have a podcast. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. Are you sticking around for hours?
Oh, yeah, I'll be here for hours.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, I can plug everything in hour two.
Don't
never
plug
mind.
Any
yeah,
I want to plug Mark's podcast, edge.show.com. Yeah. So just go see that.
And Michael's a frequent visitor, and we got to get Anna in, but she's very busy.
I'd love to do the show.
We don't have her address, so we can't send an invitation.
We'll wait till the voter information comes out, and then we can.
Except then we'll have Anna on.
Yeah. All right, guys, let's take one more quick break. When we come back, Grace will join us, and we will begin hour two. Stick around.